These chapters highlight Nehemiah's faith, his leadership, and also his strategic approach to rebuilding Jerusalem's protective wall.
This is Mission 66, taking you through the Word of God from the ministry of Bible teacher and pastor, Dr. Luis Seau. In partnership with Transworld Radio, Mission 66 is produced and heard around the world in several languages. Let's hear from our teacher, John Matthews, and his co-host, Esther Sisulu, as they start us off today in our survey of God's Word.
Welcome to the program where we read the Bible chapter by chapter and receive some explanatory comments from our Bible teacher and friend, John Matthews. Now, today we'll begin reading through the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah was a Judean who served as a butler to the Persian king Artaxerxes. But he was heartbroken at the news that his beloved Jerusalem was not doing well. The city had been sacked and burned many years before, and even though there had been a first wave of Judeans back to the city, rebuilt the temple, the residents of Jerusalem were in a very, very bad way. But Nehemiah resolved to do something about that. Now today, as we look at the first two chapters, our theme will be, what are you requesting?
Esther, thank you so much, and a very warm welcome to Mission 66, and a very warm welcome to the book of Nehemiah. Great to be with you as we reach this book, and it fits right in, you know, with the historical context which we've been looking at of late here on Mission 66. And, you know, we've seen, haven't we, in past episodes, the people of Judah and Jerusalem, they were taken captive by the Babylonians, and it was as a consequence of years and years and years of idol worship, of people wanting to do things their own way and turning their back on this incredibly patient God. But God saw that that wasn't working, and so he allows them to be taken into captivity. And it's because of that idolatry and their disrespect of his essential way, his moral law included in that. But as prophesied, Babylon is taken over by the Medes and the Persians. And you have this Persian king, his name is Cyrus, who decides that any Judeans that want to are allowed to return to their homeland. And last time, as we finished the book of Ezra, we saw that the first and the second waves of those exiles, I'll call them returnees, perhaps another word I'll use, these guys had already gone back to Jerusalem, they'd rebuilt the temple, and they'd also experienced this spiritual revival under the leadership of Ezra the priest. But there was one huge job that still needed to be done. And that was Jerusalem's wall, which was still in ruins, broken down. The gates had been burnt to ashes. So you have this city with this now newly rebuilt temple, but it doesn't have a wall. And so it's vulnerable and it's really at risk of being overrun again. So now we get to this account. It's the book of Nehemiah. And it takes us through, we're going to journey through the events around the year 450 BC before Christ. And these historical accounts focus on the rebuilding of that wall. And it's an incredible narrative to think. I think to myself, Esther, how on earth did they do these things and build these incredible constructions? No electricity in those days. But that's what we read about here. And also, when you look to do something of great value and worth for God, there's opposition on the way. Make no mistake about that. And we'll see that as well. But this is a focus on the rebuilding of the wall, but also overall, the restoration of the people during this period. And so it's worth noting before I start reading Nehemiah that he writes this report in the first person. So let's read it. Verse 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates, well, they're destroyed by fire. And as soon as I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and I mourned for days and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples, but if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. They are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name and give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. You sense, don't you, as you read this, Nehemiah's heart and its beating for the homeland of his fathers. And yet, at this point, he's powerless to do anything because he's employed as a butler and as a cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. But he knew the God of his fathers, and he knew where to take his distress. And so he prays to God about the situation in Jerusalem, and he reinforces that plea with fasting. Now, we should point out that the last verse in Nehemiah at chapter 1 reveals that Nehemiah is the king's cupbearer. What does that mean? Well, another way of saying it was that he was effectively the king's wine taster. So you see, kings, they used to have a servant to taste the food and indeed the wine before the king took that food and wine, so that if anybody tried to poison the king, the wine taster, well, they were the first line of defense. So a risky job, but someone had to do it, I guess. And if that wine taster didn't drop down dead, well, then the king knew he was going to be safe to indulge. And so perhaps that gives a little hint that the king considered Nehemiah expendable. But let's go on into chapter 2 and see what happens. This is what it says. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and I gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid, and I said to the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king said to me, What are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, How long will you be gone, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, If it pleases the king, Let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I had asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. So clearly, the king was on good terms with his wine taster and thought plenty of him, and he gives him permission to go on this work project back to Jerusalem. He even gives him a written letter of consent with the king's seal, which gives him access to building materials, plus safe passage in case anyone questions him for being there or comes across him and tries to give him some grief. So then in verse 9, Nehemiah arrives on his mission, and it says, "Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel." Now we're going to hear more about those two characters in the coming chapters. But first, verse 11 and onwards, as Nehemiah says this, "So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work." So here we see Nehemiah very much still in the planning stages, but when he's ready to reveal, he does. And here he goes in verse 17. "Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble that we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision.' And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, 'Let us rise up and build.' So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of this, they jeered at us and despised us, saying, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' And then I replied to them, 'The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem.'" And as we saw in the book of Ezra, there are opponents rising up trying to stop the rebuilding of the temple. So it is again here in Nehemiah.
This is Mission 66, and today, dear friends, we are in the book of Nehemiah. Now, we've only just gotten started journeying through this book, and I imagine that as we move along, there'll be some questions that arise from your side. And with that, we'd invite you to connect with us on our social media platforms on Facebook and on Instagram. And there you can leave your questions and your comments and be a part of the Mission 66 conversation. Well, my name is Esther. And John, seeing as we are heading into our question and answer period, I suppose we can get started with a historical timeline, a chronology of the return of the Judeans from captivity, and where this all relates to where we are in Nehemiah.
Yeah, good idea. Okay, well, let's take a whistle-stop tour through the key dates then right now. And of course, this all takes place after the Judean captivity. So here we go, 539 and 538 BC. King Cyrus of Persia, he decrees that the Judeans are allowed to return if they wanted to. And it was in 538 BC that Zerubbabel leads the first wave of exiles back to Jerusalem. And that was Ezra 1-6. 536 BC, a couple of years later, work then begins on the temple in Jerusalem, Ezra chapter 3. And then in the following 6 years, from 536 to 530 BC, opposition arises during Cyrus's reign, and we saw that in Ezra 4. And then there followed a period of years when the work on the temple stopped because another king called Cambyses takes the throne, but the prophets Haggai and Zechariah encourage the people to get busy and rebuild the temple in spite of opposition. And then we get to 520 BC and work begins again under the Persian king. That's Darius I. That's Ezra 5. 4 years later, 516 BC, the temple is complete, Ezra 6. Now we go forward a few years to 483 to 471 BC. This is a 12-year period, and we have those events in the Book of Esther under Xerxes I. And then let's go forward another 13 years to 458 BC, where we see Ezra leading the second wave of exiles back to Jerusalem, Ezra 7 through 10 for that. And then another 14 years later, 444 BC, Nehemiah approaches the king, which we just read about in Nehemiah 2. And he's about to lead, is Nehemiah, the third return of exiles to rebuild the wall.
Well, thank you for spelling out that wonderful timeline. Now we know where we are at, now that we're in the Book of Nehemiah. But, you know, I'm really interested in your take on Nehemiah's title as the cupbearer to the king. You kind of gave the impression that this was a risky position. It wasn't quite as prestigious as some of us might think it was, you know, being at the service of the king.
No, and it reminds me a little about the dangers of working in the mining industry. You know, the miners back in the day would often bring a canary bird in a cage into the mine with them because of the risk of poisonous gas emanating from the rocks in the mine. And so they'd watch the canary, because if the bird stopped singing or dropped over dead, they knew that there was gas in that place. And so they'd exit the mine pretty quickly. Well, Nehemiah was a little like that canary in the mine, because a cupbearer was more than just a royal servant or a butler. He had the job of tasting the king's wine, so that if somebody tried to poison the king, and that happened back in those days, well, it was the wine taster who would die first. And I believe that explains why the king was paying really close attention to Nehemiah's face, because he notices, doesn't he, that Nehemiah, that all doesn't appear well through his facial expressions, and he was out of sorts. And so that's what draws the king's attention to Nehemiah's concern.
I'm not sure that we'd all be running towards being in Nehemiah's position, but, you know, I feel like we kind of sense some kind of hesitancy on Nehemiah's part, because he wasn't as quick to ask the king for what he needed, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it says that he breathes this short prayer asking God to give him favor with the king. But as it turns out, he hadn't any need to be quite so nervous as he was, because the king simply asks him, well, what exactly are you asking for? And when we want something, we shouldn't think that everybody's a mind reader. And it's important to articulate what it is that we're wanting to say. And remember in the Gospels, when the blind people came to Jesus and they asked him, what is it you want me to do? And they said, sir, we want to have our sight. They didn't say, well, isn't it obvious what we want? It's possible that Jesus knew exactly what they wanted, but he wanted to hear them come out and say it. And they received their sight. And God invites us to ask, seek and knock, but we must come to him and be straight with what we want of him. Sometimes we can beat around the bush with God, can't we? And we can use false modesty. But I can hear him saying, what are you requesting? And when we articulate what we want, then we can identify the answer when it comes, and not forgetting that Jesus says, seek first my kingdom and then these things will be added to you. So if we come to him with the right heart, and he recognizes that, he is a father who so wants to answer our prayers, and when we're in line with him, those things are pleasing to him.
Well, John, yeah, I think that really speaks to the intimacy and the closeness that God desires with us in relationship. But in this case, with Nehemiah, you know, he's the guy who's going to rebuild the wall at Jerusalem. But in this context, what would you say is the importance of rebuilding the wall?
Yeah, it's a good question, because walls don't have the same connotation for us now as they did then. In biblical times, you know, cities were all fortified with walls, and they had these heavy gates to keep anyone out who didn't belong there. So a city without walls was a city without any military defense. And when Nehemiah learns that Jerusalem has no wall, it was like learning that they were in bandit territory with no weapons, no way of defending themselves. They had this restored temple and they were starting to bring themselves back to God. But Jerusalem is this place on a high promontory, which made it more defensible than if they were located on a plain, but still it doesn't have a wall. So they are vulnerable.
So John, Nehemiah, of course, is a servant of the king, but they kind of seem to have quite a special relationship, all things considered, right? And his request for this extended leave was granted without much hesitancy. And I think that maybe speaks to the kind of relationship that they have.
Yeah, it does. It does seem as though they were on good terms, doesn't it? And the king grants him time off for this unexpected request. There's no doubt about that. And so you've got that. And then on the other hand, there might be the issue that if the Persians knew that if Jerusalem was overrun, let's say, by one of Persia's enemies, sooner or later, it was going to be a problem for them. And they would have known the position of the city and its high elevation. So perhaps King Artaxerxes saw this opportunity to allow his servant, a trusted employee, if for want of a better word, of his, to go and do the work for him. So he has this line of connection and contact. So there was mutual benefit, certainly, in him allowing Nehemiah to go back and fortify that wall.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about the enemies that potentially could have posed some problems for Persia.
Well, the Persians now had control of the same area that Babylon had before them, and that included Judea. And we see Nehemiah's adversaries accusing him of planning a rebellion or a revolution against the king. I remember those verses? We've come across Sanballat and Tobiah. And then there's Geshem, the Arab, who were among people who could have risen up. And so there, I guess that emphasizes the importance of ensuring that everything was in order in Jerusalem for the benefit of the Persian Empire. And Persia, by way of note, is modern-day Iran.
So these men that you've mentioned, do we have more information about them? Who were these guys?
Yeah, well, Sanballat was a Samaritan leader, and he was an official of the Persian Empire, and he lived in the time, obviously, of Nehemiah, mid to late 5th century BC. Tobiah was an Ammonite, and he was an official as well. Now, the Ammonites were historical enemies of Israel. And then you have Geshem, who is an Arabian official who held some kind of office as well. Now, we don't know too much more about them than what we see written there.
Fantastic. Well, John, lots of details in today's episode. So let's go ahead and try to summarize what we've learned in these two chapters.
Yeah, so we see this guy, Nehemiah, who is a trusted servant of King Artaxerxes, and he's moved by the plight of Jerusalem, and he wants to do something about it. And he seeks God's guidance, and he acts decisively, and then he inspires others to rebuild the city's wall, despite opposition. And so Nehemiah 1 and 2 just tell the story of the beginning of Nehemiah's mission to rebuild the walls, that crucial step in restoring the city's security and indeed its dignity after the Babylonian exile. And the narrative opens with Nehemiah. We have him as the cupbearer to the Persian king Artaxerxes, and he receives this troubling news about Jerusalem's broken walls and the burnt gates, and he's distressed. And he responds in his distress with prayer, fasting, and confession, acknowledging the sins of Israel whilst also appealing to God's covenant promises of restoration for his people. And he humbly asks for favour as he prepares to approach the king. And then in chapter 2, the king says, well, what is your request? And Nehemiah courageously takes courage and asks to be sent to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. And despite his initial fears, Nehemiah is able to articulate his needs clearly, and the king grants him permission along with letters to ensure his safe passage and indeed access to materials to aid the process of rebuilding. And then he arrives in Jerusalem and he surveys the damaged walls. He does that discreetly and he formulates a plan. He then rallies the people and inspires them to begin rebuilding. Despite some opposition from local adversaries called Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. And I think, you know, Esther, these chapters just highlight Nehemiah's faith, his leadership, and indeed his strategic approach to rebuilding Jerusalem's protective wall. And next time, we're going to see how fast this project is completed when the people put their minds to the task in hand.
This is Mission 66, a program that's heard in several languages around the world. And we want to thank you so much for your prayers and your financial partnership with this ministry as it allows us to continue reaching listeners across the world. Now, if you would like to make a donation to the ministry, visit mission66.org today, or perhaps you'd like more information. You can send us an email on connect@mission66.org. That's connect@mission66.org. Well, friend, we trust that you enjoyed this episode of Mission 66, studying through the book of Nehemiah, and we'll continue next time with our teacher, John Matthews. So until then, may God bless you.
That's it for today's episode of Mission 66. But before you go, make sure to check out mission66.org for your free study guide. It's a great way to get more from the Bible and to see how it connects with your life. Cruise through the scriptures with John and Esther, chapter by chapter. Grab your free study guide at mission66.org and be all set for our next episode. While you're at the site, shoot John and Esther a message or ask them a question. You can also become a Mission 66 global partner with your donation, helping Mission 66 get to more places in more languages. All the actions at mission66.org. Mission 66 is a ministry partnership of TWR and Dr. Luis Seau.